Welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us here on air, as we are every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And we're going to be following the money as per usual. A couple of interesting guests today. Jessica Clement, who is with the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. And then followed up, I'm going to be talking with Sean Riley from the Federal Times about sequestration and the like. Jesse, are you with us?
I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Well, glad to have you. And we've had you on the show a number of times. You've had you keep being reincarnated. You were a long time associated with the Federal Managers Association before you moved over to NARF.
Yes, I've been here almost a year now.
Okay. And you worked on the Hill as well, didn't you, Jesse?
I did. Prior to going to FMA, I was on the Hill for about 3 years, and I will kindly ask your listeners not to do the math for my age.
Okay, that's right. 21 and counting and holding.
Yes.
Jesse, a couple of things. 2009 was our, the year 2009 was arguably the best year that federal workers and retirees ever had legislatively. I think there was a period in the Nixon administration when things got really good for them, but 2009 is certainly the best in modern times. And then the bottom fell out. So what happened?
Well, I have no arguments about 2009.
Yeah.
I actually refer to that year as probably the best I'll ever have in my entire career. And then all these reports started coming out about federal employee pay and how it is grossly more generous than their private sector counterparts. I believe it started right towards the end of 2009, beginning 2010, with the USA Today articles that analyzed federal pay and found that federal employees, by their calculation, were overpaid when compared to their private sector counterparts. And then you saw other think tanks jump on that bandwagon, and you know, you had reports from Heritage and AEI and the Cato Institute following on the heels of that. And that really started to shift the tide. And of course, you know, the economic situation of our country and the grass is greener mentality certainly didn't help.
You know, it's interesting you say that because rarely is there a watershed moment when people know when something happens. But I remember you and I and Bill Bransford, Washington attorney, were on a panel. I think we were in Palm Desert, California or something. It was tough duty, but somebody had to do it.
Somebody's got to do it, right?
But Bill came in with that newspaper, and it was a front page story, maybe above the fold, and he held it up for all assembled to see, and he said, "This means trouble." And boy, was he right.
I remember that. It was, what, August 2010,
yes.
I believe?
Yeah.
And that was the second time that USA Today had run one of those articles. And, I mean, lucky for us, everyone, you know, all 1,000 people at that conference had that newspaper in front of their door that morning. And it really drove the discussion we had on that panel. And you can definitely point to that as the turning point.
You know, I got an excellent email just this morning from somebody who said that the average person doesn't know what goes on in the government any more than they know what goes on in the news media or in a butcher shop. You know, it's you know it if you know it. And he was pointing out that he's with the Army, and for years he had to dispose of mustard gas and nerve gas. And he said, "I wonder how many members of Congress have to show up for work every day in a chemically treated suit wearing a gas mask."
I don't think very many of them.
Yeah, it's really really interesting how this can happen. And of course, I think it's ingrained in the American psyche that we want to believe government workers are overpaid and underworked.
I think there's this grass is greener mentality. There's a lot of misconceptions out there about what federal employees do, who they are, how much they're paid. And I would say similarly, there's a lot of angst directed towards Congress right now. There's a ton of misinformation out there about what they're paid, their retirement system, and those of their staff as well. There's this overall mistrust running rampant in our country that I think breeds these sort of, you know, chain emails that cross your inbox every day.
I've seen some news stories, too, about members of Congress who, during a time of federal pay freeze, have been giving their staffs bonuses.
I saw that as
and
well.
And they ask them why, and they said, well, they're doing good work.
So, right.
Interesting. Hey, Jesse, most of the federal and postal unions have been in the Democratic camp, at least their leadership, for as long as I can remember. You know, with there was one exception during the Reagan administration, but they, every year they endorse a Democratic candidate for president. Most of the people they back politically are Democrats, and there's a couple of Republicans they give to, but sometimes it's almost in the dead of night. They don't want anybody to know it. NARF and some of these other groups, FMA and some others, have taken a different approach.
Well, NARF does not endorse candidates for president, so there's one, you know, difference
right.
between us and some of the other federal employee groups. We, you know, we have a political action committee, as do a lot of these other groups, which gives money to candidates and their campaigns. And we, you know, we take a multifaceted approach in deciding who's going to get that money. And it's really on the basis of their voting record in Congress, the relationship they have with our local folks on the ground, and how much they support our issues and federal employees and retirees. You know, it is overwhelmingly Democratic, but we don't choose candidates based on their party affiliation, but rather based on how supportive they are of our issues.
Right. I think Buck McCowan, it comes to mind, from California, has been on your good side for many years.
GPO, the sponsor of the GPO and WEP repeal bill, yes.
Right, right. Hey, federal payment has been frozen now for 3 years.
It
looks like it's going to go on for more. But federal retirees continue to get cost of living adjustments. How did that happen?
Well, cost of living adjustments are calculated using a formula set forth by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which basically judges inflation. There were 2 years there where there was no COLA adjustment for anyone, Social Security recipients or federal retirees. And then this year, I believe it was a 1.7% increase. I believe last year it was slightly smaller than that. But for the 2 years prior, they didn't receive a cost of living adjustment. I think you're giving me a prime opportunity here to explain the difference between the Social Security COLA and the federal employee pay raise. So I'm going to take it if you don't
mind.
Do
it. Yes.
When Congress decided that federal employees should get a raise every year, it was in 1990 in a law called FEPCA. And the law passed, signed into law by First President Bush, as a means to close the gap between public and private sector salaries and allow for locality pay. And locality pay is based on, you know, market rates. What does a comparable job pay in a given area? The pay raise for federal employees as appropriated by Congress is meant to close that gap. It is not meant to provide a cost of living adjustment, unlike the Social Security COLA, which also, you know, affects CSRS retirees and FERS retirees, which is meant to be a cost of living adjustment to account for rising goods because of inflation.
Well, you know, it's funny you'd say that because I heard a member of Congress the other day refer to the fact that members of Congress weren't going to get a pay raise, but he termed it as a COLA. And a lot of times people do it out of ignorance, but sometimes they intentionally do it, because particularly politicians, because the idea is we're really not getting a pay raise. We're just keeping up with inflation. But in fact, a pay raise is not a COLA and vice versa.
Correct. You do see a lot of lawmakers and, you know, federal employees themselves, they refer to it as a COLA. That's how they understand it. But that was not the intent of the law back in 1990.
I remember years ago talking with Judy Park, who was the chief lobbyist for NARF at that point, longtime lobbyist for NARF. And she said every year we, meaning NARF and the other associated employee groups, every year we can delay that action, a detrimental action to the COLA, that is like giving people diet COLAs or changing the formula, is a major victory for federal retirees and people who are working.
Right now, I think that is a threat that is very, very visible, that everyone should be aware of, because this isn't something that just impacts federal employees and retirees. It impacts everyone, you know, everyone who gets a Social Security check. There are serious considerations being given to changing the formula used to calculate the COLA to something called the chain CPI, which would lower your average COLA each year by about 0.3%. They did a 20-year historical average, and that's what it ended up being. And 0.3% doesn't sound like a lot. You're like, oh, it's no big deal. But compounded over 30, even 40 years that people may be retired is a huge sum of money.
Yeah, compounding works both ways. And when you're getting less, when you're getting 0.3% less than you would have under the current system, that is a really big deal indeed. The name change CPI, it sounds almost like a horror movie. The CPI stands for Consumer Price Index. And that's there are a number of CPIs that the government uses to gauge various things. And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, the backers of the change CPI, in addition to saying how much money it would save in the future, save the federal government, and by therefore cost retirees, but they say it would save so much money, but that it's more realistic because it takes into account the fact that when things like a steak, which is part of the market basket, when steak goes up, people switch to hamburger.
Right.
And we need to take a break here, just get your thoughts together on that, and we'll talk about it. Be right back here on Federal News Radio. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Jessica Clement, now with the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, formerly with the FMA, and spent time on Capitol Hill, but maintains she's still 21 years old. So that is some doing. Jessica, we were talking about the change CPI, the Consumer Price Index, before the break, and this is one of the things. I'm glad you brought it up, because of all of the threats facing federal workers, it seems to me, and I think a lot of other people who cover this and watch it, many people are focusing on the least desirable, if you will. Like an awful lot of people are worried about changing the retirement formula from the highest three-year average salary to the high five. It's never happened. It's been around for years. It's a proposal. But if it did happen, worst case scenario, people would still only have to work a few months more, maybe 6 to 8, to boost their annuity back to the high three level. And yet that seems to be the thing people focus on. And I know NARF and other groups have said, no, the bigger danger are things like vouchers for health insurance and this change CPI.
I think the chain CPI, now that a third year of the pay freeze is all but a done deal, I think the chain CPI is going to be the next big fight for not only the federal employee groups, but also groups like AARP who advocate on behalf of seniors. Right before the break, you were talking about how people refer to the chain CPI as a better measure of inflation because it takes into account buying habits. And like you said, when the price of steak increases, you may buy a cheaper steak, like flank steak, or you may buy chicken. And I think that, you know, is a valid assumption to make. However, the current formula used to calculate the COLA, which is the CPIW, assumes that people in that group, which is urban wage earners under the age of 62, pay about 5% of their income towards health care costs. Seniors, however, people over the age of 62, spend about 12% of their income towards health care costs. So it is the position of NARF that the current formula doesn't adequately reflect the costs incurred by seniors. The chain CPI only exacerbates that problem.
Well, I guess you could make the argument, too, that, okay, if you move from prime steak, whatever it's called, to ground round, to hamburger, the next logical step eventually after being chained for several years is cat food.
I hope not. Let's hope not.
Yeah, we're not going to get it. What do you see are the threats coming up now? Sequestration, you know, it's here. So far, we haven't seen many, if any, of the effects. They're talking about furloughs, but those are next month. They're talking about cross-the-board cuts. And I know a lot of people who get a federal annuity benefits and people who get Social Security and military retired pay are asking what impact sequestration is going to have on that, if any.
Well, I think something that's getting lost in the sequestration talk is that this is not something that just ends on September 30th of this year. You know, furlough notices have gone out. You know, at the worst, employees will see one day a week lost for 22 weeks. That's 20% of their income gone for 22 weeks. But come the start of the next fiscal year, if Congress and the president haven't agreed to some sort of grand bargain or even some sort of short-term bargain to find these cuts elsewhere, sequestration is going to remain in effect for the next 9 years. So we have several several fights ahead of us. One, making sure by the time fiscal year 2014 starts that there is some sort of bargain, so federal employees aren't continuing to be furloughed into the new fiscal year. But also, what happens in that grand bargain to federal employees and retirees? You know, I think the chain CPI is on the table. The president put it out there. Republicans love it. I'm obviously speaking in very broad terms there. And a lot of Democrats seem willing to give on the chain CPI for an increase in revenues if Republicans agree to an increase in revenue somewhere along the line. So whatever happens, you know, short-term bargain or grand bargain, what they decide could also have an impact, you know, on the people NARF represents.
Well, a lot of people in the federal community seem to focus almost exclusively or exclusively on the Republicans and the House, conservative House Republicans in particular. But the fact is that the two-year pay freeze came from the White House and the commission it appointed, and President Obama endorsed it, and he also endorsed higher contributions for federal employees' retirement benefits, not as high as the Republicans did, but that the White House has been in on a lot of these things, including the chain CPI.
He did. The president was the first to propose the pay freeze. It was in advance of, you know, his fiscal commission, which proposed a three-year pay freeze. And then, you know, Congress followed suit. The president's budget for the last two fiscal years has included an increase in retirement contributions for all current federal employees of 1.2%. You know, it's not prospective. It's not just FERS. It's all of 1.2%. But then you have some lawmakers in Congress calling for an increase of 4%, of 5%, of 7.5%. You know, there's varying numbers all over there. And I think one of the things that lawmakers are conveniently forgetting is that they already raised retirement contributions in the law which extended the payroll tax holiday. And they did so by 2.3%, which means FERS employees who entered the government at the start of this year or since then are paying four times more for their FERS benefit than employees who were already on the rolls at the start of this year.
Yeah, that it is hard to fix blame here, particularly if you want to get into the political arena and say that it's always the other guy that's doing it.
I certainly feel the blame game is not helping anyone on the Hill these days. You look at what happened with that sequestration hearing yesterday, and, I mean, it was very little substance and so much finger-pointing. Well, what good does the finger-pointing do for us now?
Yeah. So what's on the immediate horizon?
Well, I think the Senate is poised to pass the CR, hopefully, you know, this week, which will freeze pay for a third year and does keep funding levels at their sequestration levels for the most part, which means nothing will change in the realm of furloughs. After that, probably today, the House is going to vote on Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan's budget, which arbitrarily reduces the size of the workforce by 10% through attrition and calls for a normalizing of federal retirement benefits to bring it more in line with the private sector, although is very, very slim on specifics in that regard. So that's another thing, you know, we need to keep an eye out for today. So after the CR, after the budget resolutions are passed in their respective chambers, then I think our next fight's going to be how do they work to prevent sequestration in the coming years? Is it a short-term bargain? Is it a grand bargain? And regardless of which one it is, they may be looking towards the federal community for additional cost savings.
Well, you know, the approval rating of the Congress is at just about an all-time record low. And a lot of people are focusing on the fact that for the last couple of years, it has not done its primary job, which is to approve budgets and appropriate money to run things. The government's been running on a CR, the continuing resolution, and continues to run on a CR. But I was at a debate the other day, and someone said that over the last, I think they said the last 31 years, only five times has Congress approved budgets for all federal agencies, and four of those were in the last years of the Clinton administration.
I know. It's getting really frustrating, you know, for us to watch them not get their jobs done in a timely manner, but also for federal agencies who don't get their funding levels until halfway through the fiscal year. And then it's a scramble. You know, you can't plan. You can't plan trainings and workloads when you don't know how much money you're going to have.
Well, a lot of people out there say they would take off if they could get a buyout. Are you hearing anything about buyouts? I mean, it's obviously it's late in the fiscal year for that sort of thing.
I think you saw a lot of the buyouts, what was it, probably about 6 months to a year ago.
Yeah.
A lot of the agencies put out buyouts. Obviously, the Postal Service was the most recent, and the number of people who took the Postal Service buyouts directly attributed to the spike in retirement numbers, you know, that we saw in February. I haven't heard anything more recently than what's been going on.
Right, and one thing, too, people want to know if they're going to sweeten the buyouts. A, they're probably not going to offer any, but one thing to bear in mind is that the Postal Service lowered the value of its buyout, so it's sort of making you an offer you couldn't refuse, and if you did refuse it, the next time around, they were offering you less.
Right, and one thing to keep in mind, too, is the buyouts aren't really attractive to everyone, you know, regardless of the payout. If you are not retirement eligible, you will lose some of that money by starting to draw an annuity earlier than your age requirements or your years of service that may not balance out, you know, that $20,000 buyout or even $25,000. So, I mean, just because, you know, someone's offering you $25,000 to retire doesn't mean that works, you know, for everybody.
I've heard several financial planners say, particularly about federal employees, if you're retiring because your debts are such that you really need that buyout, then you shouldn't retire.
It's probably true.
Okay. Hey, thank you, Jessica Clement. We're going to have you back, and we're going to take a short break, and then I'll be talking with Sean Riley from the Federal Times. Mike Causey here with Your Turn. Glad to have you with us. And we're going to be talking with Sean Riley. He's a senior writer with the Federal Times. Sean, are you with us?
I am. How are you,
hey,
Mike?
Thanks for standing by. Appreciate it. As we have for the last few weeks now, so much stuff, so much to talk about, so little time.
Indeed.
What about this fiscal year 13 spending bill?
Well, at the moment, we're a week away from the expiration of the current continuing resolution that expires March 27th, and at the moment, we don't have a replacement. You know, the House passed its version of a full-year fiscal 13 continuing resolution / spending bill, but the Senate, as usual, is taking its time, and, you know, the presumption is that something will get passed, but as usual, I think we'll be down to, you know, either a cliffhanger situation or something close to it.
Well, it's interesting to me, the psychological roller coaster that if you're paying attention, probably the smart people are ignoring all of this, and it's whatever's going to happen is going to happen. But for those of us who must follow it, and junkies and people who need to follow it because they're federal workers, it seems to me that sometime last week, for whatever reason, a lot of the pressure seemed to go away, that there was suddenly a feeling that there would be a compromise.
Well, I think there's, you know, from the people we've talked to, there's certainly a consensus that both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, see that the political damage of triggering a partial government shutdown would be so great and would hit both parties pretty hard that it's just something you don't want to do. But the issue is, particularly now that we are into sequestration, is, you know, and cuts are now mandatory. You've got a number of people, you know, members of Congress who want to try and, you know, cushion the impact of those cuts on various agencies and programs. But I think, you know, overall, you're right. I think there was sort of a general agreement or, you know, realtering of conventional wisdom that there would be something passed in time to avoid that shutdown. We just don't know exactly what it's going to be at this point.
Yeah, well, the guarantee is that it will probably be, as you say, at the last minute.
Very likely, or close to it. Now, Congress is supposed to, you know, they're hoping to get out of town within the next couple of days before their Easter Passover break. So presumably they want to get it done by the weekend, but, you know, they'd hoped to have a vote in the Senate yesterday, and they didn't have it, and here we are today.
That's right. They haven't had a break for several weeks.
Yeah, exactly. The poor things, they're getting tired.
Yeah. The furloughs, is it possible now that some kind of resolution appears to be on the horizon, is it possible there won't be any furloughs or there won't be as many?
It's possible there won't be as many. There will definitely be a lot of furloughs still, but there is some effort underway to give some agencies more flexibility or a little bit of added funding or to avoid them. And it depends on which bill you're looking at. You know, both the House and Senate are essentially on board with giving the Defense Department, you know, which plans to furlough pretty much its entire civilian workforce of about 800,000 employees, some more flexibility by reallocating funds from things like military personnel, where they don't need as much money as they had last year, into operations and maintenance, which covers a lot of things, including civilian payroll. Now, there's not a clear agreement on this, but there are some analysts who say that if this happens, DOD would have the option of avoiding at least some employee furloughs, but you know, there would also be competing demands for those additional O&M funds, say from the from TRICARE, from, you know, for training, readiness, that kind of thing. So DOD managers would have to make some choices. But, you know, we got a comment from the American Federation of Government Employees that they would certainly be pushing agencies to get more flexibility to use that to at least reduce the number of furloughs.
Well, you know, suspicious minds always bring up the thing called the Washington Monument cut at a time like this, and that is when Congress, for whatever reason, fails to approve a budget or fails to give an agency the amount that it says it needs to do its job. The agency comes back and says, okay, in this case, Interior says we're going to shut down the Washington Monument. Now, that's not an issue because the earthquake we had a couple of years ago shut down the monument. But agencies that have a high public profile, the National Park Service and places like that, who say, gee, we're just not going to be able to provide these services for people. And, of course, defense is the 800-pound gorilla in the room because it is the Defense Department. It is the largest federal agency. We are currently involved in 1.5 wars. And if they say we're going to have to furlough virtually everybody, huge number of people, for 22 days, and then if there are six contractors for each civilian employee, that in and of itself would seem to be the kind of thing that would frighten almost any politician.
Yeah, it's certainly gotten the attention of those who have large military installations or large number of DOD civilian employees in their districts. I mean, one of them, for example, is Congressman Blake Farenthold from Texas, who represents Corpus Christi Army Depot, where this could be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
He's very concerned about furloughs, but the question is, what do you do about it? And certainly that, you know, the suspicions that the Washington Monument approach is alive and well are certainly shared by some members of Congress. I was at a House Oversight and Government Reform Committee hearing yesterday where this issue was, you know, repeatedly raised about whether it was necessary to do, not so much for DOD, but for other agencies to take these steps, whether other ways to cut costs. You know, what's interesting is my colleague Steve Losey did a great story this week looking at how agencies are implementing different furlough strategies. You know, DOD, for example, as we just said, is going to furlough almost all of its civilians for up to 22 days. You have other agencies that are going to do much less. You've got some, say, like EPA, which are going to essentially shut down or plan to shut down for 3 days because everyone will be required to take a mandatory furlough. There's really kind of a patchwork of approaches out there, you know, which seems, I guess, raises some questions about, you know, consistency and whether everyone's being treated fairly.
Yeah, and you know, you've had stories, we've had stories on our homepage, too, about the Agriculture Department, which seems to be going down a different road and saying we can move money around. We've discovered we can move money around, so we're apparently going to avoid furloughs, and yet the CIA and others are coming out and saying the worst is going to happen.
Well, I mean, the Agriculture Department's an interesting case because, you know, I think they are, as far as I know, they are still looking at furloughing food safety inspectors who work in meatpacking plants, and those plants cannot, by law, as I understand it, open if an inspector is not present. So that raises the possibility that some of these plants may have to shut down for days in which inspectors are being furloughed. And the response you get from agencies is that, no, they're not bluffing, that they just don't have a choice, that under sequestration, you have to cut across the board every program, project, and activity, PPAs they're called, and that they just have very limited discretion in how these cuts are applied. And, of course, for many agencies, their biggest cost is personnel, and that's where you're going to find the savings. I mean, for DOD, they have to cut $46 billion. They say that furloughs will save $4 to $5 billion of that.
Well, the Agriculture Department is into many, many things. It is hundreds of occupations and things that it does, but two of the most important are the meat and poultry inspection. I mean, that's how we eat.
Mm-hmm,
that's
right.
And how people make money. So if I wanted to do a Washington Monument cut at the Agriculture Department, that's where I'd start.
Yeah, and that's, I think, again, there's real suspicion on the part of some members of Congress that they are doing, the Ag Department is going ahead with these, with furloughs in this particular, you know, bureau or branch, precisely because the impact will be felt. It could, you know, there's a potential that, you know, meat and poultry prices could go up as a result because of short, you know, reduced supplies. But again, the response you get is that they, you know, that they're, you know, from managers overall, is that their hands are tied. They have to do this in response to sequestration. Now, I should note that on April, early next month, say around April 1st, I guess perhaps April 2nd, agencies are supposed to provide Congress with their revised operating plans, you know, essentially detailing how they will respond, how they're managing to deal with sequestration, and that should provide some more insight, hopefully, into exactly how they're approaching it.
There are a number of government offices and agencies that actually make a profit. The Internal Revenue Service comes to mind. Mm-hmm. It collects the vast majority of the revenue you have. We have the old Minerals Management Service in the mm-hmm. Interior Department. But you also have agencies that make a profit or maybe off of their customer fees or something, and IG offices that by identifying waste, fraud, and abuse can save the government a lot of money. How are places like that being affected by the sequester?
For the most part, I mean, there's some exceptions. They're getting hit just like everybody else, and that means, say, for for the Defense Department Inspector General, they're still waiting to see what their final level of funding will be in this fiscal 2013 spending legislation we're just talking about. But that means they would take a 8.8% cut, just like most other parts of DOD. And for non-defense agencies, that means a 5% cut. And it does seem, you know, I was talking to Scott Amy, who's with the Project Government Oversight, an outside watchdog group, who was saying, you know, this seems to be penny wise and pound foolish that, you know, if you're cutting back, say, on IGs who, you know, produce, you know, what's known as a return on investment that's very positive for the government in terms of the, you know, the savings they identify and the money they bring in through recoveries, restitution, that kind of thing, you know, it seems counterproductive to cut their budgets and reduce the amount of oversight they can do. But this, again, goes back to the across-the-board impact of the sequester. There are really very few accounts within the government that go unscathed.
Well, and you have the Internal Revenue Service, which it's disputed how much money they bring in for every dollar they spend, but it's a lot more than what they spend. And they have specialists who go into businesses, you know, major companies, and come back with millions of dollars in back taxes.
Sure, billions, I would say, probably.
Yeah.
And certainly, I mean, it's going to be very hard to quantify that, but you have to assume that if some of those people are being furloughed or not going to be working as much as they would have normally, that there will be some kind of reduction in the amount of money they're going to bring in. The question is just how much.
Okay, I need to take a short break here on Federal News Radio. When we come back, I want to ask you about federal workers who are overstretched on the job because of sequestration. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Sean Riley. He's a senior writer with the Federal Times, and we've been covering all of the sequestration and budget stuff. Sean, before we move on to the next subject, I wanted to ask you about workload and overworked feds, but you were talking about the impact of sequestration on places that people don't necessarily associate it with. You know, everybody thinks, well, Washington would take a big hit and some other cities. But I had a friend who was from Ogden, Utah, and she went home a couple of weeks ago and was sitting around having coffee with a group. And she said everybody at the table either worked for Hill Air Force Base or the IRS.
It's fascinating. One other aspect of that, I mean, you know, the vast majority of federal employees, as you know, don't work in the Washington, D.C.
Yeah,
area.
Exactly.
And in many cases, they are in, you know, particularly with the military, they are in areas that don't have a heck of a lot of, you know, going on. I mean, places like Ogden, Utah, or, you know, in military installations in areas that are, you know, because they are remote, they have lots of available land. There's not many other opportunities for employment. So when when cuts hit home, they hit home pretty hard, and there are not that many opportunities for people to find work elsewhere.
Right, and there are a lot of these depressed areas. They've been depressed for years, but the primary employer may be a federal prison and or a VA hospital if they're lucky. But
exactly, and as we know, if the late Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia made a very concentrated effort to basically be a one-man economic development machine for his state,
absolutely,
by requiring federal agencies to relocate there.
Yeah, that
was very the impact. And you know, these are good-paying jobs with, you know, for the most part, with good benefits. And I can't think of any area that's not happy to have them.
That's right. And that's right. West Virginia has a lot of things: Interior, Internal Revenue Service, whatnot. Your colleague Andy Medici has a really interesting story this week in the Federal Times, and it's about federal workers who are overworked, their agencies are overstretched. What's that all about?
Well, this is a great analysis that Andy did. He went into sort of a deep dive into the results from the latest Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey, which got close to 700,000 responses from about 292 agencies. And look, he focused on the responses to two questions in the survey. One was whether employees agreed or disagreed with the statement that they had sufficient resources to get the job done. And then the other one was whether they thought their workloads were reasonable. And he went not just to the agency level, but to the bureau, the component level, and came out with a list of basically the 25 agencies where employees say they're most overworked and lacking in resources. And the results are really interesting. I mean, at the absolute bottom was the Agriculture Department's Risk Management Agency, which I suspect many people haven't heard of. It's an important agency and does a lot of work, say, on, I believe, federal crop insurance, the Federal Crop Insurance Program. And you had had some areas that agencies or components that you would expect to be on there, for example, like the Veterans Benefits Administration, which handles benefit applications from disabled vets. I mean, they're chronically behind, with huge backlogs, always overworked. A number of components from DHS, like Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the National Protection and Program Directorate. But then you had, a number of different Agriculture Department agencies, like the Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, Departmental Management. You had EPA Region 10, which is out in Seattle. I'd like to know what's going on there. The Bureau of Land Management Interior, Voice of America, Office of Workers' Compensation Programs of the Labor Department, Defense Security Service from the DOD. So it was a really interesting for cross-section of agencies and not at all what you would expect to see in some cases.
I had lunch the other day with a friend, and he likes to argue. And I was saying, I think I made the mistake of saying that I don't believe a lot of polls, because you'll poll fewer than 1,000 people and then determine how Ohio is going to go in the presidential election based on that. And I said, that's not good enough for me. And he of course, took issue with it. But in this survey, 690,000 employees, I mean, that's a humongous number.
Yeah, I mean, this is not, as far as I know, this is not a scientific survey.
Sure.
And, of course, it depends. I don't know a whole lot about polling, but I do know there's a trend called, there's a phenomenon called self-selection where, sometimes the people who feel most strongly about an issue will be the ones most likely to respond. And it could be that in this case you've got the people who are most unhappy, who feel most overworked, under-resourced, whatever, are the ones responding. But certainly if I were a manager in any of these agencies, I'd at least think these findings, warrant a little more investigation and to find out exactly, to what extent these are shared by employees across the component or agency and what can be done about it.
It would be interesting to see, how many people just walk down the street and pick 20 people and ask how many of them believe that they are overworked. And I'll bet you the vast majority would say it even if they didn't really believe it.
I think there is a tendency, and the corollary is, of course, that I think most people would agree that they're underpaid for what they do. But again, I mean, these are not, this is out of almost 290, about almost 300, bureaus, components, and et cetera. And not everybody feels, these agencies on this scale, ranked, were in the lowest tier. So it's not universally shared. You know, these responses are not universal across the government. So again, it's, you know, I think it's a kind of a canary in the coal mine. You know, it may not be completely indicative of what's going on about the entire, about how the entire workforce feels of these particular components, but it is something that, you know, I think would be worth a further look.
Well, I noticed Andy's story. He quotes Henry Romero, which is a former OPM official who knows about these things, and he said that a lot of agencies are in mission overload, I think is the term he used.
Yeah, and it's important to remember, and this is all pre-sequestration. You know, at some agencies, it's just going to get worse in terms of what they're doing. And certainly, you know, Veterans Benefits Administration is the classic example. They've, you know, with the influx of claims coming in from vets who have served in Iraq, Afghanistan, I mean, those issues aren't going away anytime soon.
Yeah.
And now VA, I should say, note, is exempt from sequestration, so they won't be affected. But, I think a lot of agencies do feel like they're essentially, you know, running on empty or a little bit below.
Well, as you said, too, VA is chronically behind just because of the nature of its work and the people it deals with.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got coming up?
Well, we're looking ahead. I mean, you know, of course, we're, like everyone else, we're following what's going to go on, what's going to happen with this spending bill, because if a major issue is given that we only have a week to go before the current CR expires, is that a big concern of the Senate, where the bill is still being worked on, is not to add too many amendments that would substantially change what's already been passed by the House, and thus, you know, make it more difficult to get a reconciliation between the bills that can quickly pass.
Good enough. All right, John, thank you so much for being with us. And remember, our shows are archived here on our homepage. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.
We'll